It is an honor to welcome the great Walter Jacobson to the Steve Cochran Podcast. Nice of you to do this. Thank you.
Well, I'm so happy to have been invited, and I thank you.
Now, I'm going to start in a weird spot.
Okay.
I want to talk about Walter and Bill, because there was a point, this was pre-Oprah, pre-Michael Jordan, where I would argue you were the two most famous faces in Chicago. That level of fame is not something a newsman reaches for.
Right.
But when you reach it, you have to deal with it. Was that tough?
Right. That wasn't too bad. But it starts with a very interesting story, I think, and it'll give you some insight into our personalities and
sure.
what led to that kind of fame. And that was that Channel 2 News was at the bottom of the heap
right.
in 1970, 70. 71 and 2 and 3,
sure.
really at the bottom,
right.
to a point where the bosses in New York sent in two guys to take over this station and somehow make it better.
Okay.
One of them was Van Gordon Sauter, whom you knew, I'm sure, who was a newspaper guy, and the other was Robert Wessler, who was a TV big-time guy in New York. And they were sent here and told to make this station better, do whatever you can. They were kind of kooky guys, both of them together, especially when they were together. So they came up with this idea of a newsroom live on the air. Great idea. Mm-hmm. And they wanted Bill...
Had never been done before, right?
I don't think it had.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly not in this town. It
right.
may have been in some little markets. But it was an idea that they got together on and really worked hard at it. They must have built, they did, I know, build a huge studio mm-hmm. right near here with an active newsroom desk. And they wanted Bill Curtis. Curtis was at that point a CBS correspondent in California.
Right.
He was heading toward his goal, which was an anchor on the network.
Right.
And he was doing very well there. He was on all the trials, big California trials.
And am I wrong about this? Weren't they thinking about Curtis as a potential success? In,
yes.
To Walter, right? To Cronkite.
Yeah. They talked about that.
Yeah, he was one of the people mentioned.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he needed a promise. He didn't want to leave California to come here.
Sure.
But they told him they needed him here, and if he would agree to come, that they would give him some consideration as an anchor. Nobody said to him, Walter Cronkite, you will take his place, but a network anchor, which is what Bill's track was and what he really wanted to do.
Right.
Then they came up with this really crazy idea. I told them that they would team him with me. I said, I'm not an anchor man. I don't want to be an anchor man. At that point, Steve, I was doing commentary, political commentary, which is what I really wanted to do.
But you should say, too, you also had established yourself as one of the great reporters who could find a story, get to the bottom of it, report it. But yeah. you hadn't made your bones as an anchor anywhere. You were a reporter and you were a commenter.
Right.
Yeah.
And I had no interest in being an anchor.
Right.
But, you know, anchor is the top of the ladder in this
sure.
business. And when they said, we'd like to team you up with Curtis, I first said, a crazy idea. This is an Irish town. The Irishmen have been anchors.
Right.
Everybody loves the Irish. Fahey Flynn and John Drury
sure.
and John Coughlin. So I said, you're not going to put some Jewish kid in there
right,
to be
right,
an
right.
anchor man. You can't sell me in Chicago. They were persistent. But I said, well, I mean, okay, why not? They offered me like $50,000, which was a lot of money. At that time, I said, I'll do it, but only if I can do the commentary as well.
Good for you. Good for you for having the vision to ask for that.
Yeah. I said, no way would I give that up because that was where I wanted to go.
Sure.
And they worked it out in New York somehow because it was against New York CBS policy to have an anchor man with an opinion,
right.
which is a reasonable position for them to take.
Sure.
But if you isolated the role and made it very clear that it was commentary and opinion.
Right, separate from the stories you were reporting on, sure.
Yeah, that's right. So Curtis was led here with some not very fair remarks by them. He didn't know that he was going to be teamed with me. I really didn't know how much of a team it was going to be. Curtis thought he was coming here as the anchor.
Wow.
And he would have me as his kind of sidekick as the commentator, like Floyd Calber and Len O'Connor.
Okay, right? sure.
When he got here on a very cold day in the winter, and decided even then that I think I'd go back if I could, because California was nice and warm and comfortable.
Sure.
He didn't know me other than by name. I didn't know him other by name, but we kind of clicked right away, as even though he was disappointed that it was a team.
Right.
But we both understood, you know, you've got to work together, and if that's what they want, let's give it a shot. And crazily enough, it did work.
It worked brilliantly.
Yeah. He was this straight man from Kansas.
Right.
And I was this wiry kid from Chicago.
Right.
And I was difficult on the ear. You know, I mouthed off. I really didn't know the rules of being an anchor. And he had to bear the responsibility of getting me back in line when that was
important.
But
that was part of the chemistry. That was part of the excitement.
That's right.
The look of the newsroom and the studio combined, that was a cool set.
That and the minicam.
Hadn't been seen before.
No, the minicam was really what did it.
When did you know it was working? Ratings aside, people in general wouldn't understand this, because why would they? But there's a point when you know any show works. There's a buzz that goes on in the public. There's an advertiser push. But it's sort of an ephemeral feeling. It's just something, a sense that you have that you're getting there. When do you think that was?
Probably we felt it very early on. We started in 1973. Bill and I felt, because we were really then motivated to do well. And we had many talks with the brass at that time about how we could make news. What we wanted to do was make news that was news.
Sure.
We were both kind of offended as you know, we were really our journalists, and we were offended by the way local television was going with the main stories. When it leads, it bleeds. When it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, dirty laundry.
Yeah, and dirty laundry, good. But dirty laundry is investigative reporting, and that's fine. But we wanted it to be active and serious. And then we were going nowhere. I think Fahey Flynn was on Channel 7 at the time, and he was, you know, a Chicago icon, really. And that's, people liked the comfort of the nice guy. They were irritated by me especially, and to some degree Bill.
Sure.
So at first, for the first actually 5 years, we made no progress. And the ratings, of course, would determine what CBS in New York would say to CBS in Chicago to do.
So CBS had to have a lot of patience.
Yeah,
and the local guys here must have taken a lot of heat for keeping you guys together and on the air.
That's right. And they were about to give up. For some reason, Steve, that nobody could figure out, it just began to work 5 years in, and then it took off. And then we were, as you say, we owned the market.
Did they promote you at all?
They promoted the newsroom.
Okay.
The music became familiar to people. It was a time when there might have been, when everybody might have been ready for change, and the television critics were big in the newspapers,
yeah,
and they had
sure.
a lot to say about it, and they were writing about it, so we had a lot of luck.
And what, it must have been a lot of word of mouth then. The word of mouth must
have
been.
Well, I guess it was, I'm sure.
How did that level of notoriety affect how you covered the news? Did it make it better or worse? Because here's my point. You want somebody to talk to you about a story. If you're the top dog in town, you're going to get your phone call returned faster than the number three.
Right. And we had that advantage because as we began to develop and the audience followed, that we got the numbers, which meant a lot of people were watching, so people were responding to us.
Right.
And, you know, when you're on television every night for an hour, oh, I think we started at 30 minutes and wound up being an hour.
Right.
Maybe it was an hour to begin with. But that's a lot of time of exposure.
Yeah.
And people who watch the news, Chicago is a news-crazy town.
Yep.
Politics-crazy town.
Absolutely.
You know? After sports, the biggest game in town is politics, right? And that's what we were interested in doing, and that's what we focused on, especially me. So an anchorman becomes part of the family. In Chicago, Drury was definitely part of the family. Floyd was part of the family. Fahey was part of the family. But they were older and
sure.
passing on. So it was good for your question was, how did the notoriety?
Yeah.
I hesitate to use the word fame. Yeah, it sure helped, because when I'd call, they had seen me, and
sure.
and then they would, then they wanted to talk. People always wanted to talk, and I was easy to talk to. So, yes, I would say, in answer to your question, that being on the air every night did help us get an audience.
And am I remembering the timeline right? The only reason you guys ended up going your separate ways was Bill got the offer to do New York. Is that accurate?
Half accurate.
Okay.
Bill got the offer to anchor the CBS Morning News in New York.
Right.
And I was distraught. I was having a ball. We loved what
we
were
got a
doing.
Good thing going here.
Yes, and I was sad that he was going, but I'm sure I couldn't say, no, please don't do that. Sure. I may have said, please don't do that. I probably didn't say, get your ass back here. And
right, what you were thinking.
Right. You know, I'm 4 years older than Bill.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and everybody pictured Bill as the father figure and Walter as the scrappy little kid.
Yep.
So I said to him, you know, you got to do what you got to do it. And I was surprised at CBS to break this thing up. Maybe they knew. You may know more about that than I did because you've been in it a long time.
Yes, I have.
That once you get going, you don't want to change.
No, no.
Not
and what do we know about a truth of Chicago? Chicago, my home, your home. Chicago loves what it knows.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily know what it loves.
Very
and it,
good.
And it takes a while to get that. And once you get that, you don't want to give it up.
That's right.
So that's the past as a quick story, a bit of an aside. Right. The present is, for a guy like you that's covered politics for all of these years, we're in a mayoral race now where it seems like every Democrat in town has said, I'm in.
That's right.
Following the Daily Legend and then following a very strong mayor, you can disagree with him, but a very strong mayor, are you concerned about the future of the city and leadership?
Good question.
Because I am, is the reason I bring it up, selfishly, because my opinion has always been you need a strong mayor in a town like this because you got to control the aldermen.
Right.
And I don't see any of these candidates that I see, you know, easily fitting into that position.
Well, I certainly would agree with that, but you never know. The position may make the candidate better than he is before he becomes the mayor. They need this. I agree with you. They need a centralized government because it's so dispersed. There's so many neighborhoods. There's so many tribes, as we call them.
Right.
That the mayor's got to be in control and act affirmatively.
Yeah, and so have a cohesive vision.
Right. I don't see any special reason, at least right now, to worry about the future of Chicago. You say you do. What is it about it that makes you?
I think you, not an authoritarian, but I think you really need someone who is feared on some level.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And none of these candidates rise to that level for me. Now, it's interesting because Bill Daley being one of them, Bill Daley to me doesn't fit the mode, or the mold, I should say, of the Daley brother. And the Daley father, certainly. He's kind of the kinder, gentler Daley.
That's right, yeah.
But he's probably more qualified than anybody in the country.
I would say he's very qualified. He's number one or two. Gary Chico's very qualified as
also,
well because
yeah.
of his experience.
Sure.
You know, president of the Board of Education. And
does the mayor of Chicago have too much power in regards to the state? Because you look at New York as a similar situation. The mayor of New York is very much the mayor of New York. The rest of New York State, Syracuse, Rochester, Buffalo, those are those towns.
Right.
The mayor of Chicago gets things and makes decisions that affect the entire state.
Right.
Is that too powerful?
No, I don't think it's too powerful. I think that power is absolutely necessary, especially if you know how to use it when you're dealing with the General Assembly in Springfield. I think that power is really great to have.
And it's an economic engine
absolutely.
that needs to be supported.
Absolutely. And that you know, Rahm has been, in my judgment, more successful than most people think he is because
he's
got a difficult personality and he's arrogant and he does what he wants to do. And that's helped. He's done a lot of really good things for the city and is leaving on a high. So, and that's because, at least in some part, he is a tyrant.
Yeah. Yeah,
but people who work for him say they love him.
Yeah, tremendous loyalty.
Loyalty.
And
doesn't seem lovable, does he?
No, I wouldn't say lovable. I don't think he would either. But he's much more likable than people would think. You know, he's become a regular guest on the show.
Yeah.
I've told him before. I said if you showed the side you show to this audience regularly, People would love you like you've never been loved before.
Yeah, that's right. When I say he's not lovable, I mean the way he conducts himself in public.
Right.
But when he starts talking to somebody, yeah, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think he's done a much better job as mayor than he's been given credit, but history will tell that story.
Right. So who can succeed him? Who can do
what? It's tough shoes to fill. It's very tough.
That's right.
Yeah, it's very tough. And
well, you know who's the toughest? I think Preckwinkle's the toughest. She's really tough. She doesn't sit back on anybody. I'm not too happy with the things she's been doing, but she's tough.
She's got to be tough, right? Because women aren't given the same opportunities. And Cook County is a huge county that has agendas in every different direction. So, yeah, she's very tough.
Yeah.
But Preckwinkle reminds me of the big local story that, and it's somebody that you've known forever, Ed Burke, Alderman Ed Burke, the second most powerful guy in the city by title. I'd argue at times the most powerful guy in the city. He certainly controls the money. And much like Mike Madigan in the state house, the rest of the country doesn't do it this way anymore. You know, you go to New York, you go to L.A. is not a good example because there's not really a city there so much. But any big city, there's usually not one boss politician that's part of the city council that has the kind of power Ed Burke has. So Ed Burke's in trouble. The FBI doesn't come in unless they feel they have something. We don't know where that case is going to go, but I've known Ed for a while, always had a good thing with him. These talks, these rumors, these whispers about what Ed's up to or what Ed knows feels like, you know, the cliche where people go, well, that's Chicago. Has that finally caught up with the, you know, the old institution?
Well, it sure looks like it has, in large part because the media has been making such a big play, such a big story out of Burke's problem right now. And right at the moment, Burke is a drag. I call it the Burke baggage. These candidates who have been taking his money, his largesse, candidates who have been given to him, the Daley family and the Burke family have exchanged political contributions for years and years. Gary Chico worked for Burke. Preckwinkle was given a fundraising party that earned her $116,000. Mendoza has been on Burke's good guy list. So
there's such a network of people that are tied to him, whether they want to be or not, that this story has tentacles that I don't think we've begun to even see yet.
Well, we'll have to wait to see what happens once the decision is made. It's not going to be an easy transition from the strength of Emmanuel to, I say Preckwinkle's strong, but I hesitate to use the words arrogant, but she's got some of Madigan's or some of Rahm Emanuel's arrogance. She doesn't tolerate too many disappointing dissenting opinions on everything she does.
It's true.
But she's going to have a hard time getting elected, you know, because this town is just is crazy ethnic.
Yep.
Ethnic and religious crazy.
Well, it goes to the neighborhoods you were talking about.
Yeah.
Tribes.
The tribes. That's the word I was just trying to use again. And the reason Harold Washington was able to win, you know, the first black mayor in a town that was still not black, much less black now than it is right now.
Sure.
And Harold Washington was able to coalesce. There was not competition from the African American community against Harold Washington. There is a lot of black competition against Preckwinkle, and if one or two of those other candidates divide up some of that black vote, then Preckwinkle's not going to have an easy go.
Right. I could very easily see her being part of a runoff, but I can't imagine there won't be a runoff.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. Right.
So all of this, and I'm going to bounce back again now. All of this reminds me of all the great stories you've covered through the years. The easy Walter Jacobson go-to is when you were the homeless guy, and everybody talks about that story, or Walter was the bat boy, you know, those old Walter stories. I want to know a story from you that you're immensely proud of that we don't talk about.
Okay. Very good question. And it depends on what subject matter generally we're looking at.
What's one that pops into your head?
Like, well, no, but a case of ratings if I'm focused on the ratings, okay, then John Wayne Gacy was the biggest one I ever had. That interview with him on Death Row and the way it was promoted by the station.
Sure.
But that wasn't my favorite story. My favorites are going to having been to all the Democratic and Republican conventions, because I'm a politics guy. I fancied myself when I was a kid as one day being Walter Lippmann, not a TV guy.
That's interesting.
And I would say that the Democratic Convention of 1968, you and I can talk about any of these, was a very big one. The Gacy was a very big one.
How about 80?
1980.
Yeah, the convention in 80, I assume, were you with the Democrats or the Republicans?
The Democrats.
Because they're on the Republican side. You had the Gerald Ford switchover. You had Jimmy Carter come out of nowhere.
Right.
But all the convention, the convention business, such that it is so different now than it was when you were a kid and I was a kid.
Oh, right.
You know, the way they select candidates, the way they approve of candidates, the way they handle the platform and things. I don't know if it's a good thing that the power has been so decentralized there. Maybe it is.
Well, in a convention setting, I would say it is. And the difference also is in the way the media was handling them. I mean, those were really major, major shows, millions of dollars spent on those things. And I remember the 1968 convention when Walter Cronkite had a big booth at the, where was it, in the meat?
The Hilton you're talking about?
No.
Oh, where the convention was. What was it called, the old convention center?
No, it was the old stockyard.
Yeah.
And
they built out a studio for him, basically.
Yeah, huge. And he was in his I was a local reporter. CBS was Cronkite, WBBM was Curtis and Jacobson at that time, and I was a reporter at the convention, and I was thrilled to be able to walk into the booth that Cronkite had, and I met the most disappointing experience with him. Because I had pretty good sources inside City Hall in Chicago.
Of course you did.
So I knew that there was a movement inside City Hall to get Ted Kennedy, on the ticket as the presidential nominee.
It's a big story.
Yeah, but nobody was talking about it because everybody figured it was Lyndon Johnson, and if he didn't make it, maybe then Hubert Humphrey might.
Right.
But I walked into the booth and said to Walter Cronkite, he was sitting here, as we are now, with nothing going on at the moment, and I said, my name's Walter Jacobson, Mr. Cronkite, and I'm your local reporter. And he looked at me and said, well, what do you want? And I said, I have a story that I think you would really like, because it would be a scoop, and that is, I would like to tell you about it, and it has to do with what the Chicago machine is doing to try to turn this convention the way it wants it.
Sure.
And he just dismissed me. Go take your story somewhere else. So I walked out with my tail between my legs thinking, my God, that's Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America.
What a disappointment.
Yes, I was terribly disappointed. Heartbroken. But it turned out I had the good information.
Absolutely. Did he ever come around at that point during the course of the 4 days and say, bring that kid back?
Oh, no, my God, no. No. In fact, they were so busy worrying about the violence inside and outside the convention hall that I'm sure he forgot it the minute I left.
I've talked to Anna DeVlantis, our friend Anna, about this, who you co-anchored with at Fox. And I don't think people understand that the news business is a serious threat still to this day. And it goes beyond the ridiculousness of the president calling it fake news and creating the shout-downs and the violent threats. Anna's been threatened through the years by covering crime stories and things. You must have had some of that.
Nothing very serious. I once got a box in the mail with a lot of sawdust in it and the note attached to it saying, these will be your brains. But, that happens. There are crazies out there all the time. But
sure.
I never felt scared, and CBS never had to do anything.
Never afraid to cover a story, never even thought twice about it.
And I was doing things that were really aggravating
sure.
to people, especially in higher places. I mean, I know that the Daley administration made efforts to get New York to put some clamps on what I was doing. I was sent to City Hall as a reporter when the first Mayor Daley was mayor, And I would stand, I was pretty audacious. I don't know where I got the courage to do it, but I would say, and I'm at City Hall, and here's what Mayor Daley had to say today to the news media, but let me tell you what he was really thinking. Now, come on. How the hell did I know what he was thinking? I did know what he was thinking.
Right, but to go out and say it's a different thing.
Len O'Connor could get away with it because Len O'Connor looked the part.
Right.
This was television, remember, not
right,
radio.
Right, right.
It doesn't matter how you look. Len O'Connor could get away with saying anything, and I am Len O'Connor.
Sure.
He was my model. He was my hero.
Right.
I wanted to do what he was doing.
Right.
I used to sit on the floor in his office when I was at NBC. I was kind of a backup to him. And just ask him questions and listen to him talk about what he knew about City Hall and the aldermen and history. I mean, he was just absolutely fantastic. But I had no right. You know, now that I'm telling you this, I think I got to change it. I did have a right because I knew what I was saying. When Mayor Daley said something but was meaning something else, then he should be called on it. And that was my role, and maybe that's what helped make us successful.
And I've never had a chance to say this to you, but I'll say it here publicly. I think you helped change that rigidity in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
Because people who had the skill and the experience to actually throw in this note of how to think bigger about a story, I never saw anybody do it before you, and I thought it was a good thing. Because it didn't violate the tenets of a good journalist, and it did cause the audience to be more engaged. So I think you got to be proud of that.
What do you remember what you were doing at the time in the mid-70s?
Well, I was a kid, you know, but I knew what I wanted to do. And, you know, I, like the rest of the country, thought Cronkite was it. But the evolution of the Anchorman is such, and this is why you have to come back and talk more to me. You know, we'll do this in a part two version. But the evolution of the Anchorman has changed so much. You know this. As you said, the three big network anchors, that's it. We grew up in a three-channel universe, maybe four if you lived in a big city.
Right.
And then there was UHF, you know, and the funny antenna on top of the TV. And the anchors had so much power, so much power. You know, Cronkite, rightly or wrongly, is given credit for ending the Vietnam War because of that power.
Yeah.
So the evolution of the anchor, I think, is a different story than the evolution of the reporter. And maybe there's too much opining now. But if it is the case, it's because it's people who didn't walk your walk. So I give you credit for it. That's the point.
The reason I asked you what you remember doing in the mid-70s or so, when you said you were a kid, I wondered if when you were watching us, first of all, your parents watched us, no doubt.
Oh, sure.
Right? That's why
you.
And so if they turned on the news at 6 o'clock, you were in the house, so you watched too.
And then they leave it on for Walter.
You were probably too young to say to yourself, God, what is that kid doing on there? But
no,
Daley wasn't too young, and the people in New York weren't too young, and we had a lot of problems.
I'm sure at some point, because I was a cocky kid, that I thought you had annoyed me on some level, but I liked you. You're one of the reasons that I would find a way to watch it. And my father was not the warm, loving type. Come on over here, boy, let's watch the news together. I wasn't that type of relationship. But as I said, I think you deserve credit for that, and I hope you give yourself credit for it, because you're one of the first, if not the first, to do the news in that manner.
Yeah, and you know what made it possible was not only the minicam, but the visuals. I mean, somehow I developed a knack for getting a hold of people who were in trouble and could take a camera and show them in trouble. I mean, you couldn't really argue with the stories I was telling you.
And nobody was doing that then either.
No, that's right.
No. We are going to do part two and three and four of your life, because we're going to go through all of it, because you and I also need to talk in the future about this fake news thing that drives me so crazy. It's heartbreaking.
Oh.
But if there's a kid listening, or a family of a kid listening, who loves the idea of growing up being a reporter in the current world of news, is the advice different that you'd give them now than you would have given a kid 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't have even given the advice because I didn't know enough myself at that stage. But now I'd be very sincere in saying, be careful. And I know kids, a lot of kids who really would like, I mean, it's a very glamorous, wonderful, interesting, dynamic career
important
to
job.
Have. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've got to be willing to work from the bottom up. You can't become an anchor man in a year. You can't get into the Chicago market right away. You've got to go to Peoria or somewhere else in the smaller market and work your way up. And remember that you've got to try to give equal time to both sides.
Right.
It's not wrong to come to a judgment, a serious judgment, after you've given both sides a chance to talk. And my advice would be that you've got to be fair as you can be. Understand that there is no such thing as pure, is there, Steve? Pure objectivity?
No.
Who is objective about everything?
Everybody has
feelings.
Especially
politics. But you have to know how to put the opinions aside long enough to say what needs to be said. Unless you are perfectly, fully identified. I think what made it possible for me to keep going that way was that I never did an opinion piece. I never did a Walter's Perspective without a big sign underneath me saying Walter's Perspective. So I didn't pretend it was news,
right.
which is the problem today. You know, whether it's Fox or MSNBC
or CNN,
they're pretending to be objective news people, and they're not. They are all commentators.
There's way too many who are doing just that. There's almost, you know, the exception is to find somebody who cares about the objectivity right. and actually does it. And I would also say that the president has made that worse, but that'll be next
yeah.
time.
Yeah,
would
yes.
you do this again?
Oh, are you kidding? Of course.
I'll
do whatever you want me to
love
do.
Love talking to you. And by the way, for people that don't know, Walter Jacobson's Perspective appears on the Steve Cochran Show every week. And you work very hard at it, and I want people to know that. You spend time crafting it and doing all the things that the rest of us should do with putting it together. So I appreciate that.
I appreciate being on there. And when you say crafting, you know, it's harder to write short than
yes, it
is long.
Yes, it is. And yeah, you put yourself in a hospital.
That's right.
You're very right. Nice to see you, sir.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
Walter Jacobson on the Steve Cochran Show podcast.